broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta, thanking you for being here. Now, we're going to take time in this first hour to enter into the scriptures and the theme of the temple. When you first come up with the idea of the temple, you think of Solomon and you think of the building of this religious edifice that was very important to the Jews under the Old Covenant. But then you get to the New Covenant, and Jesus kind of replaces the temple, and the building gets struck down, and then you have, the church. And the church kind of defines its liturgy, and you forget about the temple. The truth is, the church embodies that temple. And Christ himself is he who is greater than the temple. But God's temple presence can be located in Scripture, going all the way back to Eden and right on through to the climax of the book of Revelation. My guest, Dr. Stephen Smith, has penned, I think, one of the richest volumes of biblical theology for Catholics. It's called The House of the Lord, a Catholic biblical theology of God's temple presence in the Old and New Testaments. Believe me, even though we're going to spend three segments entering into this biblical material, we'll only scratch the surface. So again, recommend the book to you, The House of the Lord, a Catholic biblical theology of God's temple presence in the Old and New Testaments. And then in the second hour of today's program, we're going to talk to Henry Olson. Henry goes back to the Reagan era and has been watching the development of conservative politics and conservative activism since then. He's the author of a book called Working Class Republican, Ronald Reagan and the Return of Blue-Collar Conservatism. He's a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. And I've talked with him once in the past, and I thought it's time to talk with him again now as people are asking what's conservatism's political future look like. So stay with me, but before we go to any of these guests, we get to today's headlines. And actually, we're going to just pause for a minute here before we not take the headlines, because I want you to remember that we are in the middle of our fall membership drive. We've been playing the full program, Crest in the Afternoon, for Monday and Tuesday, and today we're going to try to do as much of it as we can, but we want to make sure phone calls continue. We've got $123,900 to go to reach the goal by end of day on Friday. So give us a call now, 1-877-288-1077. That's 1-877-288-1077. I want to stress again the importance of being able to keep the programming going even as we're raising support. Otherwise, what happens is we've got to cut the programming out and just go back to, you know, constant appeals. We've tried this before. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. So we're going to try it again. We've got some great interviews coming up, too. Dr. Stephen Smith with me is an outstanding Old Testament scholar who I know you're going to enjoy. I spoke with him earlier today, and I'm sharing that interview with you now. But do keep in mind, 1-877-288-1077. That's 1-877-288-1077, or just go online, AveMariaRadio.net, and let's see what we can do to chip away at that $123,900 to go. 1-877-288-1077, or go to AveMariaRadio.net. Why don't we go back and we'll pick Crest in the Afternoon up in progress. I'm Al Cresta. In preparation for a talk I gave at the Defending the Faith Conference this year in Steubenville, I spent a lot of time in the letter to the Hebrews. And in fact, I also realized what E.P. Sanders, the great New Testament scholar, once wrote, that it's almost impossible to make too much of the temple in first century Jewish Palestine. My guest is the man who I think has done extraordinary work in helping Catholics recover this sense of God's temple presence. And Dr. Stephen Smith is a nationally known, recognized speaker. He's author of The House of the Lord, A Catholic Biblical Theology of God's Temple Presence in the Old and New Testament. He's chair and professor of biblical exegesis at the University of St. Mary of the Lake and Mundelein Seminary in Illinois. Previously, he taught scripture at Mount St. Mary's Seminary in Emmitsburg, Maryland, which is where I actually first contacted Stephen. Stephen, good to have you with me again. Thanks.
Al, it's great to be with you and all of your audience. Thanks for having me so much.
Let's go to this statement of E.P. Sanders that it's almost impossible to make too much of the temple in first century Jewish Palestine.
I remember reading that book like you. When you mentioned that quote, I chuckled because it's actually on page 8 of the introduction. And here's the exact quote. He says, "I think it is almost impossible to make too much of the temple in the first century Jewish Palestine." He goes on to say, "Modern people think of religion without sacrifice, but they fail to see how novel that idea is." And that came from a book he wrote in the early 80s, I want to say 94, 93, mm-hmm. called The Historical Figure of Jesus. And I remember reading it, and like you, it just struck me as quite a statement.
And I have to confess, it's something I still strive to understand and mm-hmm. feel that temple presence more clearly. Are Catholics actually better situated to grasp this idea of the temple, the significance of the temple mm-hmm. in our worship than most Protestants?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think so, but they maybe don't always know how to articulate it.
Okay. Yeah.
You know what I mean? As I talk with lifelong Catholics, one of the big differences I still see, even with all the advances that we have, and, you know, we've got, you know, Word on Fire and YouTube and all these media resources and Scott Hahn, and these are wonderful things, but I still find that just the rank-and-file Catholic going to Mass on Sunday loves the Lord, loves the Eucharist, and loves the Bible. But putting all those things together sometimes is a little difficult to sometimes articulate it. But I do think because this book that I wrote and is really very liturgically oriented, and mm-hmm. it begins with the temple theme all the way back in creation, and it moves, of course, through the law and the prophets and the rest of the Old Testament into the New, where really the high point of the book is, you know, John's proclamation that Jesus was speaking of the temple of his body. And moving on into Revelation. So it certainly is there for all to see, Catholics, Protestants, Jews, all. I do think we're well positioned, but as I said, I think we can use a little bit of help, and that's kind of why I wrote this book.
Indeed. When most people think of the temple, they think Solomon's temple, and then they think of the rebuilding of the temple and the period of time that Jesus lived, sometimes called Second Temple Judaism. But you make the point that really the reality of God's temple presence goes all the way back to creation. And most people would say, well, I look at the Garden of Eden, I don't see any structure there called the temple. So take us back to the garden and how that is the temple presence in the garden.
And as I do, I've got to give credit, speaking of our Reformed and Protestant brothers and sisters, I've got to give credit not only to Sanders, but to a few others as I answer this for you. Not to say that, you know, it was reading a few of the really more erudite Protestant academics that really led me to, you know, to this topic and to this book. So Sanders is one. Another is a guy, some may know this name, Greg Beale.
Sure.
Or G.K.
Mm-hmm.
Beale. And he wrote a book called The Temple and the Church's Mission, A Biblical Theology of the Dwelling Place of God. It's a very good book, but with respect to Beale, who I know a little bit, John Bergsma and I laughed when my book came out. He said, "I'm really glad because I felt like it was the Catholic response to what was there was wonderful, but maybe it was missing some things."
Yeah.
So start with what's in common. I think both someone like Beale and myself recognize that there is this sometimes very visible, sometimes it's a little bit more subtle theme going all the way back, yes, to creation and then tracing through the scripture. But then, as I said, you know, I think there's more from a Catholic perspective to fill in here, the sacraments, the Eucharist, and more. But to get to your question, No, I mean, I think it's not necessarily obvious, especially for modern English readers that are just looking at the Bible and seeing, okay, we have the 6 days of creation. You know, how is that in any way about the temple? Doesn't that come later with Moses? And the answer is sort of like, well, it does in some sense. You have that, tabernacle and the instructions in the book of Exodus, and then from there, you eventually get the temple of Solomon and so on. But if you actually look more carefully, there are a number of clues that really strike you as strange when you read the Old Testament. And I actually want to begin with a quote for you and your audience from the book of Ezekiel.
Sure.
And by way of explaining Genesis, there's a passage in Ezekiel, in Ezekiel 28, where the prophet says, you were in Eden, the garden of God. Now, a little bit of context here. We're obviously in a prophetic book, not the law, and Ezekiel's actually addressing the king of Tyre and Sidon, but that's not really the point. The point is that he's dressing this man up like Adam, but in the process of his sort of praise of this pagan king, in a sense, he goes on to say, you were in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone was your covering, and he names topaz and diamonds and all that. But then he says this, you were an anointed garden cherubim. I placed you there. You were on the holy mountain of God. And that strikes you as odd, right? Because we tend to think of the geography of Eden as very, very flat. We think of, sometimes the caricature of a nude man and woman with an apple in front of a two-dimensional tree, kind of almost a cartoonish picture.
Right,
of course,
right.
That's not the biblical vision. The vision is glorious and awesome. And what I think Ezekiel is hinting at here is there's more to that topography than meets the eye. But it's not simply one stray verse in Ezekiel. When you go back to Genesis 1 and 2 alone, there are a number of clues. One that, again, wouldn't be necessarily obvious for many English readers is the very name of God that's used in Genesis. Catholics will know the term El Shaddai,
mm-hmm.
right? It was one of these many Hebrew terms. But it really means something like the God of the mountain, El, the God of the mountain. And that's kind of interesting when you put that together with Ezekiel there. And so when you actually begin to study the topography, see four rivers flowing out of Eden. Rivers tend to flow and follow the gravity and go southward or outward.
Right.
And so you get this vision then eventually when you put it all together of something much more three-dimensional, something glorious and majestic that I and a lot of other scholars have identified here as Mount Eden. And that would be maybe the starting place to see not simply a flat garden, but really a majestic vista with a garden and then, a mountain and then a garden in or on that mountain. And what you eventually get at when you put it all together, the image of Adam as a priestly figure, which comes in chapter 2, and some of this topography, is you get this image of a kind of a primordial or cosmic temple. So on the mountain is a holy of holies, that's the garden. And then you get eventually this image of Adam as a royal and priestly figure who's called to tend to that sanctuary. So, and then it kind of just builds from there.
Huh. So the Adam, so tell me then the dominion mandate that Adam receives.
So
how does that relate to his priesthood?
Sure. So, we're told that God places Adam in the garden, and he's taken out of the ground, right? He's made from the dust of the earth, and mm-hmm. to the dust he shall return. But as he places him in the garden, one of the things, the first commandment that we get in the Bible, many Catholics will know this, is, of course, because it's so endemic and so important in our right to life and in just the whole pro-life movement, is be fruitful and multiply.
Mm-hmm.
And so we tend to associate that with this gift of natural life, and indeed it is. But I've also begun to see much more in that first commandment to be fruitful and multiply. Because if you finish it off and it says, and fill the earth. Okay, so here, so let's just pause and think about it. Here's this man, Adam, who's called in a royal and kingly and priestly way to be the governor and high priest of God's garden and to order and to perfect it. Even the naming of the animals and all that, as we know, shows this kind of royal stewardship. He's a co-regent with God, as he's sometimes called.
Mm-hmm.
But he's also a priestly figure. What do priests do? Priests offer sacrifice to God. That's what makes them different than just pastors or, reverence is priests offer sacrifice.
Right.
And so my good friend, some will know, Michael Barber, has often made the case, if you move a couple chapters over to chapter 3, that one of the ways that Adam is being portrayed is sort of as a delinquent priest in the sense that He's in the garden. He's called to steward it. He's called to have union with Eve, his wife, the woman. And yet when the serpent comes in from outside the garden, this great threat, something more like a dragon or a leviathan than a little garter snake. But nevertheless, where is he?
Right.
And actually, it's interesting. If you look at some of the older Jewish texts that come out of rabbinic Judaism, like a book called the Book of Jubilees, written just before the time of Christ, it actually fills in the cracks and says, you know, Adam, you were delinquent. You were off when you should have been there and defending your wife and laying down your wife. Okay, laying down your wife for your wife at this threat. And so what Barber does is he says, this is an image of a priest who is not focused. He's not sacrificial. He's not self-sacrificial. He's not willing to lay down his life. He's not willing to engage the threat. And indeed, it is ambiguous. When the conversation happens, right, between the serpent and the woman, he doesn't speak initially. And
right.
So he's very silent. But some early Jews, as I said, even made the argument that he was in another part of the garden. But the big picture then is that sort of he is cast out along with Eve out of the garden. So the one who's called to protect it is cast out. And what's interesting then is to go back to that statement, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth, is the idea that this high priest of the garden would then not only sanctify the garden, but as Lumen Gentium says, to consecrate the world, right? And so his call ultimately is to go out into the world to be a missionary. Unfortunately, he gets off to a bad start because he's sort of booted out of the garden rather than going off with a crusader flag over his head.
Right, you know,
he goes out in humility and in sinfulness and now very aware of his mortality with Eve. And then it goes from there. And there's much more here than obviously we can fill in a short conversation.
Sure.
But in the chapters on Genesis, I lay out some of the Hebrew terms. I'll just give you one more. In Genesis 2:15, Adam is said to serve and protect or till the soil and all of this stuff. To till and keep the land is how it sometimes comes out in the translation. So that's a very poor translation. In those terms, avad and shamar, to till and to work, are really priestly terms.
I'll tell you what, hold it there, Stephen. We'll come right back.
Today's programming on 990 WDEO is brought to you in part by a gift from our day sponsor, who would like to honor the Legionnaires of Christ and Reginum Christi on this, the Feast of Our Lady of Sorrows. We thank them for their dedication to the church and for helping its members grow in faith, hope, love, and charity.
You can be a day sponsor too. Just pick up the phone and call toll free 1-877-288-1077 and say, I want to be a day sponsor.
Join us for a family festival celebrating the year of St. Joseph, September 17th through September 19th. St. Joseph and South Lyon will host speakers Deacon Harold, Dr. Ray, and Kathleen Littleton on the role of the spiritual man and woman in the family with child care provided. We'll have a petting zoo, pony ride, moonwalk, and more family fun. Go to stjosephfestival.com. Nourish the spirit with daily mass, confession, praise and worship, 40-hour devotion, and consecration to St. Joseph. Visit stjosephfestival.com for more details.
On the next Cresta in the Afternoon.
Our topics during Cresta in the Afternoon toggle between church teaching and then using that teaching to shine a light on our world. We'll look at Christ and culture, church and world, religion and public life, from abortion to Zechariah and everything in between. Biblical criticism, Hollywood productions, academic debate, family and love, prayer and spirituality.
Cresta in the Afternoon from 4 to 6 on 990 Ave Maria Radio.
62 million unborn children have been killed in abortion. Let us honor these abandoned children. Saturday, September 18th, the National Day of Remembrance for Aborted Babies. Join me, Monica Miller, Dr. Janet Smith, and abortion survivor Claire Colwell at the Graves of Aborted Babies in Michigan, September 18th. For all services, see abortionmemorials.com, abortionmemorials.com.
Welcome back. I'm Tom Hornacek here with Brian Shanley, executive producer of Cresta in the Afternoon. And you're listening to Cresta in the Afternoon because you love being connected to your Catholic faith and seeing everything through the eyes of the Catholic faith. But this is day three. We're past the halfway point for our fall membership drive, and we got some ground to cover, don't we, Brian?
That's right. We did manage to hit our goal for the Our Lady of Sorrows Challenge in the last hour, and thank you once again to everybody who kicked in on that. But our overall goal over the next 3 days,
days is, what is that, 123,900, basically?
Yep.
So,
yes, it is.
And that's obviously a big number, and if you've been listening to these pledge drives over the year, you may be thinking, oh, we can do that. That's not too bad compared to some of the other numbers they've had. And we've had bigger numbers than that, but that's still a pretty big number. And we definitely can do it by the end of Friday, but we've got to start getting the momentum built up now, getting those phone lines lit up, so when we have the typical late-week explosion, we're not so far behind that we can't catch up. So 1-877-288-1077 is the number, 1-877-288-1077, or go to AveMariaRadio.net. We're going to get you back in just a few seconds to our regular Cresta in the Afternoon programming. We're sitting down with Dr. Stephen Smith, looking at how God reveals himself through the temple. But before we go there, we have a thank you from Tom, I think.
We do, and they went online at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMariaRadio.net, and that was Mary from Saline, Michigan, made her pledge online. Thank you, Mary. Or give us a call, 877-288-1077. That number, 877-288-1077, a one-time gift, a monthly gift. There's no amount too small or too large. Maybe you'd like to make a large challenge. Give us a call. We'll connect you with Mike, and we can set it up for you. We've had a couple of those today. That number again, 877-288-1077.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. I'm with Dr. Stephen Smith, author of The House of the Lord, a Catholic biblical theology of God's temple presence in the Old and New Testaments. First segment, we were taking a look at God's temple presence in the garden, and Adam as high priest, and we're talking about Adam's delinquency as priest, and then at the close of the last segment, we're talking about some of the language that's used to describe Adam's task at tilling the soil. And I'll let you pick it up from there again, Stephen, if you don't mind.
Yeah, so it's really interesting. And a number of scholars, Gordon Wenham is a great Old Testament scholar, has pointed this out in his commentary, The Word Biblical. And others have. Beale talks about it. I talk about it. John Bergsma does. So it's definitely, the evidence is strong. But yeah, we're talking about this verse in Genesis 2, where we often get the sense that Adam is sort of a horticulturalist. He's just a gardener.
Right, right.
And he's called to till and keep the land. But then under those are these very interesting Hebrew words. I'll spell them out for those that, you know, most don't know Hebrew. But avad, spelled A-D-A-D, and shamar, S-H-A-M-A-R. And what's interesting, Al, is those two words, as I was saying before the break, really come out of liturgical language out of the book of Leviticus, talking about the roles of the priest in the temple.
Wow.
And it's interesting, is we actually did a study, and of the vast number of occurrences of those words, of the majority of the time when they occur within just about 10 words of one another, they always refer to this priestly vocation, this priestly activity. And there's more priestly hints as well as you move throughout the Old Testament. But I think this is something, to go back to our earlier conversation, that, you know, we as Catholics understand the role of the priesthood, both the ordained priesthood and also the priesthood of the baptized. And I think this has been maybe a blind spot for some Protestants, to not seeing this temple theme. In fact, when I get to the New Testament, Al, I explained to the readers that in the 20th century, there was really a degradation of the whole idea of Jesus as a priestly figure.
Hmm.
It kind of is, especially in Protestant circles, you see this in the kind of critical circles. He's not really a priestly figure, and certainly his apostles are not. Well,
right.
Where does that come from? And I do think, not to get into the philosophical too much, but I do think in the rationalism of the 19th century, there was this movement away from high church and liturgy and, you know, kind of a Catholic sacramental view. And so in some of the German Protestant liberalism, you get this sort of, you know, movement away from any of the priestly motifs in the Old and the New Testament. But fortunately, that's changing, you know. And just in the last 20 years, well, there was Beale's book, which is a wonderful book. I'm also thinking of a guy in Illinois here at Trinity University, wonderful evangelical scholar whose name is Nick Perrin, P-E-R-R-I-N, and he wrote a book called Jesus the Temple, and he wrote another one called Jesus the Priest, and it's just remarkable. I've shared this with some of my Catholic seminarians, and when I read the quotes, they're like, well, you know, who is this? It's some thesis in Rome or something? He says, no, this is an evangelical scholar. But he's willing to look at the evidence and say, you know, in the Bible, we begin to see these things, and you can't really, why deny them? Why deny them? They might be hidden for some, but for those that really study the Bible, they're pretty clear and evident once you have the proper tools to see them.
So, I mean, this recovery of the significance of the temple, the significance of the priesthood in the life of Jesus that's occurring in evangelical Protestant circles. Do you see? And I realize this is a little bit off our theme, but I'm curious.
Sure.
Do you see that those who are working in this field, you mentioned Nicholas Parent, for instance, mm-hmm. Jesus the priest, and is there any, do they begin to think sacramentally as a result of these realizations?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I'm not sure. If I can be very honest, I thought quite a bit about this, is I think there's sort of an awakening and an opening and a movement there in certain circles in Protestantism that is open to it, but I'm not quite sure that, you know, in his case or in others that they're going to cross the Tiber anytime soon.
Yeah.
I certainly think though that in many ways what they're really doing is providing sort of an in-house critique to other Protestants to say, look, these are some of the things that we missed. And you know, just to fill in the cracks in that, you can go all the way back to someone like Wellhausen, who had this, you know, four-source theory of the Pentateuch, and without getting into the weeds on that, you know, these four sources that he had, the Yahwist and the Eloist mm-hmm. and the Deuteronomist and the priestly source, what's interesting, and I talk about this in the book, is he really lamented, Al, the fact that this, what he saw as the priestly source was all of that sacrificial stuff, right, that's in the Pentateuch, especially Leviticus, but other places too. Anything that smacked of priesthood and sacrifice and the burnt offering, he assigned to that latter view. But what he believed was that was a degradation of an earlier, more pristine Israelite religion. And what he saw is that more Israelite religion kind of looked more like Protestantism, right? In the sense that it was sort of like, you know, love thy neighbor and, you know, sort of Bible and, you know, good things, but sort of the moral law, but nothing that moved towards the sacramental economy.
Yeah.
And so that's in the background of the 19th century. And then that kind of floods into the 20th century and moves from the old to the new. So it's not a surprise that, you know, someone like Perrin and even Beale, they're sort of in the minority because they've been educated in sort of that whole movement to kind of not really see these things.
Yeah.
So I think it's a net plus, though.
Yeah, no, very good. So back then to Adam, if I understand you correctly, Adam's purpose was to, in some way, had the fall not occurred, would have been to extend God's temple presence through further and further out through creation. Is that right?
I think that's it. I think that's the basic idea. I wouldn't go too much further than that and take it too literally. And then I should say, to complicate matters a little bit, is that I do think that there's a kind of a dialogue going on between, let's say, these early books like Genesis and Exodus and Leviticus, the Pentateuch on one end, and then those books that deal more substantially with the temple. So they're like the story of it in Kings, 2 Samuel, David's story, but also the Psalms, which really are the songbook of the temple. Huh? And so, you know, some have said that, you know, the way that you would have experienced the Temple of Solomon, or even the temple that Jesus would have entered into in Herod's temple, you would have been reminded of creation. So there's a sense in which the temple is, to use catechism language, a sort of recapitulation, a kind of a perfecting, a renewing, a transforming of the creation. And I do think that is a healthy way to look at it, because if you really think about what the whole movement towards the Holy Land was worship, right? And that's the aim of creation, is Sabbath. And so when you come into the more refined later period with the temple and the sacrifices and all the festivals, in some sense, it's kind of a going back to that original mandate, right? To be fruitful and multiply, to worship God in a self-sacrificial way and in a priestly way. And we're all called to this, right? Even mm-hmm. today as Catholics, we're called to live out that same mandate from Eden.
Yeah, it is very true that often when people talk about the story of the Exodus, it's, you know, Moses liberating the
the Hebrews from bondage in Pharaoh's Egypt, and there's the great story of let my people go. But what's often dropped is the purpose of letting those people go, that they might go and worship God.
Indeed.
That was the purpose of the Exodus, was worship, not just liberation in the abstract.
That's true. Very true.
You mentioned...
No, it's interesting. No, go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I was saying...
I was just going to say you... Yeah.
No, go right ahead.
I was thinking, pondering your question about the, you know, these scholars like Perrin and others, and what do they make of this. And I just had one additional thought, and that is, I don't know what the average Protestant person does with the following verse, which takes us into the New Testament, of course. But in John chapter 2, in that scene, you know, that we were referring to, John says in John 2:21, but Jesus was speaking of the temple of his body. And I don't know how you can really, well, first of all, you can't really make sense of what that means until you first know a little bit about temple theology. You know, so the temple is the dwelling place of God. So here is the divinity in person, but also it's the place where sacrifice is offered. So sacrifice of his own body. And, you know, I think they might connect it to Calvary, to the cross, but I think that's where it would stop, unfortunately.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. 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 It's kind of, it really weakens the imagery. You go back to, you quote from 1 Chronicles 5:13-14, and I'll just say it. It was the duty of the trumpeters and singers to make themselves heard in unison in praise and thanksgiving to the Lord. And when the song was raised with trumpets and cymbals and other musical instruments in praise to the Lord, quote, for he is good, for his steadfast love endures forever. The house of the Lord was filled with a cloud, so that the priests could not stand to minister because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled the house of God. So often when people think of temple, they think of ritual, they think of liturgy, but they don't necessarily think of this kind of dynamic presence of God with his people, of which, of course, Jesus is the most vivid example of him with his people. But I don't think that connection between Jesus, the temple of his body, and this remarkable kind of explosion of God's presence in the temple, I don't think those things are connected in the normal reading of John chapter 2 there. So, yeah.
Yeah, and especially for Catholics, Al. I mean, the subtitle of this book is A Catholic Biblical Theology of God's Temple Presence. And so I'm hoping that many Catholics will pick this up and give it a go. It's not a dense or difficult read.
No, it's not.
It's got a college degree, but it certainly will be engaging. But, I mean, I think, you know, I would say don't get lost in the details of these, you know, Hebrew words. And, you know, you can take what you want from us. But read it for the narrative that I'm laying out and saying, what if it is the case that from the very beginning of the Bible to the very end, God has kind of painted a picture of what worship is intended to be? And that begins in the very opening words of the creation story, and it goes all the way to the end of Revelation. And in the sense, in the bullseye there, of course, in the very center are the Gospels. But you mentioned Hebrews. It's certainly, there are traces of it in the latter New Testament books. There's traces of it in the wisdom books of the Old Testament. As it turns out, I'm teaching a course on the wisdom books.
Yeah.
And some of my seminarians who love the scriptures have, you know, they've never read some of these books like Sirach. And we came to the last chapter of Sirach, chapter 50. And it's an encomium to the priest of Sirach's day. And I recommend any who are listening who are priests or deacons or studying or just know a priest or just love the priesthood, to read that chapter, Sirach chapter 50, and what you see is a glorious depiction of the role of the priest, especially in our day when people are questioning the relevance of, you know, the priesthood and of the Catholic Church and, you know, the abuse scandal and all these other things, to remind ourselves of God's vision of priesthood.
Very good. Stephen, hold it there. We'll come back. My guest, Dr. Stephen Smith, The House of the Lord, A Catholic Biblical Theology of God's Temple Presence in the Old and New Testaments.
Chris, and you are listening to Cresta in the Afternoon, and we're taking a quick break. Bryant Shanley here with Tom Hornacek and Matthew Hanley, because it is still our fall membership drive. We are down to $123,901 to go to knock off the rest of the goal for this drive. And as Tom likes to say, you're listening right now because you love Ave Maria Radio. You love Cresta in the Afternoon. These great conversations that we have. And I like to say, I've been producing this program for several years now, and I never quite get used to just the variety of stuff Al is able to talk about. We obviously did 9/11 stuff earlier in this week. Yesterday, we talked to a man who had been imprisoned alongside ISIS fighters, including somebody who was responsible for those horrible beheadings we saw back on the beaches of Libya back in 2015, I want to say it was. Other stuff we're talking about today. Right now, we're in the middle of this fascinating conversation with Stephen Smith, looking at, you know, diving all the way through the Old and New Testaments, how God reveals his covenant with his people through the temple. And then the next hour, we take another shift, take things another direction with Matthew Bunsen, looking at some comments Pope Francis made about abortion and Eucharist and politicians, and then go another direction entirely again. Henry Olson will be joining us discussing the future of conservatism and Republican politics in the U.S. All three of those things in the span of short 2 hours, you're not getting that anywhere except for Cresta in the Afternoon and Ave Maria Radio. And we want to get you back to that in just a couple of minutes. But first, we need you to pick up that phone and make that call. 1-877-288-1077, or go to AveMariaRadio.net. You go to the website, we've got all the thank you gifts all listed there, or we can tell you right now, what are the thank you gifts?
And it starts as easy as $20 a month or a one-time pledge at $240. You'll get Al's brand-new DVD, The Bible and the Historical Jesus. This is about an hour-long DVD that Al's done. This is the first time it's been released. What does it mean by the historical Jesus? Who is the real Jesus? What are the Gospels? Al breaks down all the myths and lies of those who deny the authenticity and the truth of the Gospels or the existence of the biblical Jesus. This is great for anybody who wants to spread the good news of Jesus Christ. Your Bible study, RCIA group, I know you're going to share this one. Okay, now when you go to the $30 a month or $360, you get Al's DVD and another thank you gift. And then $40 a month, $480. Al's DVD, a thank you gift, and a day sponsorship. And then for every $10 more a month, we add another gift. So what are the gifts? Dr. Ray's newest book, Jesus, the Master Psychologist. Listen to him. This is the best book he's done, in my opinion. But probably every author says their most recent book is their best book. But it is. It's outstanding. It's short chapters. Guys, you can digest it. It's excellent. Second book, Matthew Kelly's newest book, Life is Messy. You know, he shares his personal journey through 3 years of suffering from depression and his way out. Because a lot of us have suffered through the pandemic. This is the perfect post-pandemic book, as he gives you concrete everyday practices and activities and insights into mental health for greater peace and freedom. Then we have the documentary movie, Pray, the story of Father Patrick Peyton. Outstanding. You're going to want to own this. You'll share it with your family and friends. Even your kids will enjoy this movie. And also, backed by popular demand, I Thirst, the 40-day devotional with Mother Teresa by Father Joseph Langford. All of these are available. They're all on our website at AveMariaRadio.net on the top of the homepage. Click on Fall Membership Drive, and they're right there, and you can make your pledge. That number again, 877-288-1077.
That's the number Joseph called. It's Joseph of Celine. It's donating to Ave Maria Radio because in these crazy times, he wants to get information out about the church from a trusted source, not the secular media that hates the Catholic Church and has bias coverage. Thanks so much. Let's take you back to Cresta in the Afternoon.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. With me, Dr. Stephen Smith. He's the author of The House of the Lord, a Catholic biblical theology of God's temple presence in the Old and New Testaments. We started back in the Garden of Eden because I think for many people, that's the place where they would least think there's, quote, temple theology. But we also we've spent some time talking, of course, in the Mosaic Law, talking about the Solomonic Temple. And I wanted, Stephen, for you to pick up on this theme of the glory cloud, this idea that in the tabernacle you have the presence of the Shekinah glory, but in the temple you also have this glory of God that is almost sensible. It's that tangible. What is this theme of the glory cloud, and where does it emerge finally under the new covenant?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. So this Shekinah is this mysterious cloud. We see it in some sense over Sinai when Moses goes up in the cloud. It's, you might say it's this veil between, you know, mortal man and the deity, right? So that, I mean, we know that a few different places in the Old Testament that God says, you cannot see my face and live. I'm thinking especially of Exodus 33, where Moses begs, you know, pray, show me your glory. And I think there are a couple different ways that it comes into the New Testament. We'll get into that in a moment. But I think the idea of this is we're losing this in some ways in our culture, this notion of mystery, this notion of the transcendent nature of God. I mean, I think one of the things that, you know, that our Protestant brothers and sisters do well is talk about the Jesus as friend. And indeed, he is our friend with a capital F. He is our friend. But, you know, the biblical vision of the triune God from, you know, from Elohim in the Old Testament all the way through the New Testament and the person of Jesus and the Holy Spirit is a much more mysterious thing. And, you know, in the chapter, I devote a whole chapter to Leviticus, I describe in great detail the preparation that the high priest had to make before going into what's called the Kodesh Kodeshim or the Holy of Holies. To prepare for that awesome encounter. You don't just waltz into the temple.
Right.
And so in that chapter, talk about, you know, it may sound strange, even a little bit off-putting to us, but, you know, the high priest would stay awake for 7 nights prior to that. I can imagine doing that, what kind of, you know, energy drink he had. Right. But the idea would be to not even have what, to put it politely, a nocturnal emission, right? Even an accidental emission, you know, so from his body, so that he would not in any way bring impurity before the Lord. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, the modern person says, this is so much nonsense. I mean, can't we just relate and pray to God? And why is there all of this fear of God? And I think that really misses the mark. It's you see in the ancient Jewish tradition this holy reverence for that Shekinah, that place where God himself dwells. And, of course, in Scripture, it's twofold. It's in the heavens above, God's heavenly home, but it's also in the Holy of Holies, so that he can really be encountered in a very personal way. And so let's take that idea forward. So, okay, so the high priest prepares himself, and then what does he do? He takes, there's a sacrifice, right, a sacrificial animal, and he takes some of that blood, and he goes in, and very carefully, singing psalms, he sprinkles some of that blood sacrifice on what's called the mercy seat. That's over the Ark of the Covenant. And in so doing, he's atoning for his own sins and also for the sins of all of Israel. And it is true, the Scripture talks about, and the rabbinic tradition talks about, a cord that would have been tied about his leg so that if God were displeased and smote him, they wouldn't have to go in. They could pull him out, you know, in one fell swoop, which tells you how seriously all of this was taken.
Yes.
But then you come into, you know, the New Testament, and you see, you know, in Matthew's gospel, right, after the crucifixion, that massive veil, huge, heavy, high purple veil, adorned with jewels, was torn in two, right? So it's exposing that holy place that was so revered all the way through Jewish tradition. And I think the evangelist is telling us there's something remarkable Christologically about who Jesus is. He's the one who is the very presence of God, but also allows us that access. Like, come unto me, all who are weary and heavy laden, I will give you rest. And then that's picked up also in the book of Hebrews as well. Well, there's a Marian connection here too, because in the book of Exodus, there's this this word that's used to describe the glory cloud in Exodus chapter 40. So just a little bit of context. Exodus chapter 20 through 24 is the giving of the law. And then Exodus chapter 25 through 40 is where everyone falls asleep. No, it's not true. But it is difficult because you get all these painstaking instructions in from God to Aaron and Moses in terms of constructing the tabernacle and all of the vestments and everything else for the tent of meeting. But then at the very end of it, in Exodus 40:34, we read, then the cloud, this is that Shekinah that you're talking about, covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And this is the same word from the Septuagint of that book that is picked up in the story of Mary in the New Testament. Right?
I know. Yes.
The glory of the Lord is now, and the church fathers saw this, so they saw that what was being hinted at in a kind of, epiphany with Moses there in a mysterious way, is now being clothing the Blessed Virgin Mary as she gives birth to the Savior of the world, who is the new temple. So kind of direct connection between both the old and the new. And then you can go on into other examples of this glory cloud, and as I said, in Hebrews. And then ultimately in Revelation, at the end of the Bible, you get this notion that it's the very heavenly temple coming down from heaven, which reveals the glory of God and gives radiance to all of humanity. No more tears, no more cancer, no more death, no more rape, no more, trafficking, no more fill in the blank, and the Lord will be with his bride. So it is really a theme that moves swiftly and mysteriously through the whole of the Scripture.
Jesus' phrase, something greater than the temple is here, tell me about that.
Yeah. So, he makes a couple of really interesting statements there in Matthew chapter 10, and one of them is, something greater than the sign of Jonah is here, right? And there's that. So the comparison to the prophets. But something greater than the temple is kind of a mysterious one, because, again, if you see this only as a building where ancient Jews would go in and worship God, you're missing three quarters of it. You're missing the whole of it, right? Because the very idea is, as I said, with that high priest going in, you're coming into the very presence of God. And so I think his statement there is very much a Christological statement, very much a statement that the evangelists are telling us, cueing us in to the very identity of Jesus as the divine Son, as the new Adam, as the one who's to be worshipped. And so it's a very, very powerful statement. And again, it's not that Catholics don't hear these things. We hear these in the Mass. But then the question is, how well are they being articulated and conveyed in homilies? Sometimes very well. Sometimes we can maybe do better.
Yeah.
And then what about beyond the liturgy? What can we do as moms and dads? What can we do as elementary school or high school teachers to help really bring this story together for the people? And just one last thing I'll say is I had a seminarian recently who's a big fan of Scott Hahn and said, Dr. Smith, how does this temple theme relate to the covenant? Because I've been taught, by reading his books, that that's the central theme. And I said, well, I think that there's not a competition here. I think that when you look at the story of the covenant, that temple is kind of that iconic image that accompanies the people all the way from creation, all the way, through that covenantal story. As I said, the whole idea is to get to that land in the Old Testament where they can worship God. And so God's covenantal people worship, and that covenant is demonstrated through sacrifice, both old and new. So I think the two go together very much hand in hand.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. I agree. There's no necessary competition here. I am concerned, though, that why, what has to be done to help our people recover this sense of awe, this idea that when we gather for worship and we have the liturgy, and we are participants in that liturgy, that we are, in fact, in a sense, being lifted up, calling down and being lifted up into that glory. And I agree, the worship is meant then to extend out to the other spheres of our life, our family life, and even our work life. But how, I'm just curious, how does one go about eliciting from people that sense of awe?
I'll be honest with you, Al, I think it's got to be a prayerful activity, right? Because it's got to be multifaceted, all these things we talked about, education, school, friendships, all these things, and certainly in the church itself. But I think in some sense, and speaking especially to parents here, I think it has to begin far away from the temple, so to speak. If you go back to the Psalms and you look at Psalms 120 through 33-34, they're called the Psalms of Ascent. These were the songs, the Psalms that the Jews that lived out in the diaspora would sing on the way into Jerusalem, on the way up to the temple. You read them, and they're beautifully Jerusalem-focused. They're beautiful. They talk about the exile and God's vindication and all this stuff and the house of the Lord. But my point in that is, when you're a long way off from the temple, that is to say from the parish. So let's take, how far away can you get? Monday morning, and so my point would be here is to, I don't think will have as effective results or success if we just say, well, we're going to make the kids get up early, we're going to say a rosary first, we're going to dress them up nicely,
right.
We're going to really make it a special day. I'm for all of those things, by the way. But, I mean, I don't think that that's in itself enough. I think it's got to be holistic. It's got to integrate, you know, whether or not they go to the Catholic school, to be asking them about what they're learning, to be trying to make connections between the things that are going on in the culture, the things that their friends are talking about, even the music that they're listening to. And that, I don't mean in an invasive way to kind of like, you know, to smother the kids, but I simply mean having a kind of dynamic relationship where they can come and talk to you. I think also even going outside, I mean, if one thing this book has taught me is that there is this kind of natural beauty back there in the book of Genesis, that the creation is a gift from God,
mm-hmm.
not just something that, you know, we get in our car and go to work. And you know, so getting outside, enjoying, going on hikes, spending time in silence, and then certainly all those things that one would think when it comes to parish life. I mean, I do think how we approach the liturgy, how we dress, and how much time we allocate, and are we rushing in? Do we read the scriptures beforehand? So when we're there, we're in a mental you know, place, and we've heard them, we know what's coming up. Do we have a relationship with our pastor or someone at the parish that, you know, the kids know they can talk to them? How are we praying at home? Is it go beyond grace before and after meals? And then, you know, reading the Bible. I mean, lastly, reading the Bible, reading the Jesus story, reading the scriptures, and talking about that great story so that by the time hopefully they're 18 or 20, these kids have had a real saturation in a kind of a lived temple theology. But I think it's something that we need, you know, parish and school and teacher and parents and grandparents and all these things working together.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. And it's going to take, again, us working together, innovating ways of better communicating these truths. I just think your book's tremendous, and I hope that it's getting the support and promotion that it deserves, because I think you're connecting us with the biblical, really the theme throughout the biblical narrative, which has the most immediate impact on our lives, or at least our experience of worship. So, Stephen, thanks so much for being with me today.
Yeah, thanks so much, Al. We'll see you again.
Let's talk soon. Dr. Stephen Smith, The House of the Lord, a Catholic Biblical Theology of God's Temple Presence in the Old and New Testaments. You really have to get a hold of this. And take your time, enjoy it, chapter by chapter, and then ask, how does this relate to my own experience and the experience of my family? How do I enter into this more deeply?